Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Ongoing violence in Ukraine has left millions of people in constant fear of indiscriminate shelling, the UN warned on Friday, as efforts continue to push for access to the country's most vulnerable populations. 1 month since the Russian invasion, 13 million people are estimated to be stranded in affected areas or unable to leave Ukraine, including in the devastated port city of Mariupol. Carolina Lindell-Billing, UN Refugee Agency representative in Ukraine, said that civilians faced dangers including destroyed bridges and roads, as well as a lack of resources and information about where to find shelter.
In eastern Ukraine, in Kharkiv, Donetsk, Luhansk Oblast, as well as in the south, Kherson and Kiev. And they are blocked in these areas that are encircled or where the roads are now inaccessible due to mines and, for example, burnt-out vehicles. This has been one of the reasons why it's so difficult to get to Mariupol.
Since February, the UN and partners have delivered over 2,700 tons of food and medical supplies to Ukraine and more than 1,100 tons of water, sanitation and hygiene items. All the while, the civilian death toll continues to rise, and the UN Human Rights Monitoring Mission in Ukraine said that the overwhelming damage and destruction so far has been caused by explosive weapons with wide impact areas, which are being used on a daily basis in populated areas. Addis Ababa's announcement of a ceasefire in Ethiopia's Tigray region on Thursday has been welcomed by UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres amid deep concern for the 5 million people who need emergency food aid there. The development came as Tigrayan forces on Friday said that they would respect the truce, urging unfettered aid deliveries to the northern region, which last received assistance in December. Mr. Guterres said that he hoped the truce will translate into an effective cessation of hostilities respected by all parties in this conflict to allow for effective humanitarian access for all who need it, his spokesperson said. Civil war erupted in Tigray in November 2020 between federal troops and forces loyal to the Tigray People's Liberation Front. All parties to the conflict are responsible for multiple grave rights abuses, according to UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet. To Libya finally, where civil rights defenders and others have been forced to confess to supposedly anti-Libyan values, including supporting feminism and atheism, according to the UN Rights Office, OHCHR. In an alert on Friday, spokesperson Liz Throssell expressed concern at deepening repression of civil society in Libya involving torture and harassment off and online. She said that arbitrary arrests by internal security agents and state-affiliated armed groups had taken place, targeting human rights defenders and civil society actors under the pretense of protecting Libyan and Islamic values.
7 men, aged between 19 and 29, were arbitrarily arrested and detained by the Internal Security Agency in Tripoli between November 2021 and March this year. The ISA has since posted videos of the 7 men on Facebook in which they seemingly confess to being atheist, irreligious, secular and feminist, and to using social media to propagate atheism and contempt for religion.
A series of Facebook videos have also sparked a wave of hate speech against human rights defenders, the UN Rights Office said, noting that the names of activists had been circulated online with calls to prosecute them and put them to death if they're found guilty. Daniel Johnson, UN News. Hello, it's a month since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. We'll hear what impact it's had on the country's children and the global economy. In the show, we've also got news of a lean, green and wonderfully healthy farming initiative in Kenya that's offering former tobacco growers a much brighter and more prosperous future. Stay with us too as we find out about a super sustainable development goals book club for young readers. We'll be talking to 6-year-old Leo Rolf from Amsterdam. He's got lots of interesting things to say. And we'll be hearing from regular guest Solange Behategui-Cortez to wrap up the show. That's all coming up in this week's UN Catch-Up Dateline Geneva with me, Daniel Johnson. First, the news. In Ukraine, more than half of the country's children have now been displaced since Russia invaded exactly a month ago. UN Children's Fund UNICEF said that 4.3 million children are on the move. This includes more than 1.8 million who've crossed into neighboring countries as refugees and another 2.5 million who are now internally displaced inside Ukraine. UNICEF Executive Director Catherine Russell described the development as a grim milestone that could have lasting consequences for generations to come. And she warned that youngsters' safety, well-being and access to essential services were all under threat from non-stop horrific violence. The development followed renewed appeals to end the war, including from UN Chief Antonio Guterres, who said on Tuesday that it's time for a diplomatic solution to be found to end Russia's invasion of Ukraine and also end its unwinnable and indefensible war there.
The war is going nowhere fast. For more than 2 weeks, Mariupol has been encircled by the Russian army and relentlessly bombed, shelled and attacked. For what? Even if Mariupol falls, Ukraine cannot be conquered city by city, street by street, house by house. The only outcome to all this is more suffering, more destruction, and more horror as far as the eye can see.
The global economy is on course for a potentially devastating 1% drop in projected growth this year, UN development economists UNCTAD said on Thursday. The UN body's latest forecast put global growth at 2.6%, down from the rosier 3.6% forecast made last September. And the main contributing factor is the Russian invasion of Ukraine, UNCTAD said. Rising inflation is making matters worse for developing countries already weighed down by a $1 trillion debt burden to pay back creditors, the UN body explained. And it insisted that too little financial help has been forthcoming to help them withstand exchange rate instability, rising interest rates, and soaring food and fuel prices. Here's UNCTAD Secretary General Rebecca Greenspan.
We are asking for the strengthening of the measures that will help developing countries to cope with this situation. It's very important to activate the immediate funding, the rapid funding instruments that the IMF has.
In Kenya, a sustainable agriculture project has helped farmers move away from the harmful practice of growing tobacco in favor of a healthier crop with the help of the UN. The initiative, supported by the UN Food and Agriculture Organization and the World Health Organization in cooperation with the Kenyan authorities, aims to bring an end to the global tobacco epidemic. Kenya is the first country to participate in the scheme, which offers training to tobacco farmers so that they can switch to alternative crops that are easier to harvest, such as beans. Tobacco growing accounts for less than 1% of Kenya's economy, but its farmers and their families are exposed to serious health risks from the nicotine that's absorbed through the skin when handling wet tobacco leaves, exposure to heavy use of pesticides, and to tobacco dust. Here's longtime tobacco grower Alice Acheng Obare.
Right now, my kids have time for homework. But during tobacco farming, they did not have time. I would also like to tell tobacco farmers that they should come and see my chest x-ray from my doctor. My chest is full of smoke. I can't carry heavy stuff and I can't walk long distances.
So far, growers have sold 135 tons of beans to the World Food Programme, bringing them significantly more income than they earn from tobacco farming. The headlines there, and now on to other news. And one of the most important jobs the United Nations has is to work closely with member states on achieving sustainable development by 2030. This involves finding solutions to ending poverty, making sure that there's enough food to go round, that people get the healthcare and education that they need, and that we take better care of the climate, among other urgent priorities. In all, there are 17 Sustainable Development Goals, or SDGs for short, and to help boost awareness and support the initiative, there are SDG book clubs for young readers all over the world. I was lucky enough to meet one enthusiastic SDG book club member, Leo Rolf from Amsterdam. He's just 6 years old, but reading is already a huge part of his life, in an impressive two languages, as we'll find out. But first, let's hear from one of the founders of the SDG Book Club, Sherry Aldiss, who's also the director of the UN Regional Information Centre in Western Europe.
Well, the SDG Book Club, or Sustainable Development Goal Book Club, we use a lot of acronyms here, was a wonderful idea and one of my favorite projects that we created at the United Nations. We created it in September 2018, and really with the idea of encouraging children ages 6 to 12 to read, first and foremost. That contributes directly to one of our sustainable development goals, number four on quality education, but also to get them to learn about the values and the principles about the sustainable development goals in any of the official six UN languages. So we have it in Arabic, in Chinese, in English, and French, and Russian, and Spanish. So it's really important to be able to reach children in the languages that they speak, particularly as we are addressing this to children as young as six. And we created it in cooperation with several partners. So we came up with this idea together. So the International Publishers Association, the International Board of Books for Young People, the International Federation of Library Associations, the European International Booksellers Federation, and the Bologna Children's Book Fair. So really a wonderful group of book professionals, as I say, booksellers and librarians and publishers, and then our colleagues at the UN as well.
And this coincides with the Bologna Book Fair from the 21st of March. The theme this year?
The theme of the book was always about children's books, obviously. The Bologna Book Fair is about children's books, and we're very excited to be launching a new part of the Children's Book Club with a partner called Cindy. We'll be doing some read-alongs at the and recording of children reading books at the Bologna Book Fair this year.
How fantastic. Listen, just wait there, Sherry, because on the line, we also have Leah Rolfe, who is a six-year-old reader. And I can see you, Leo, and thanks so much for joining us all the way from Amsterdam. You're speaking to us after a busy day at school, no doubt. So can you tell me about your favourite book?
Mr. Men books.
I used to read those too. Do you have any other books that you like to read?
The Big Book of Blue.
The Big Book of Blue. What's that about?
Sea animals.
Sea animals. Okay. Maybe you could tell me what it is you like about reading.
Learning about octopuses.
And what do you like about octopuses?
The squid ink.
They've got squid ink. Yeah. Yeah, they use that as a weapon, don't they? And to run away. They're very impressive, aren't they? Have you ever seen one in real life?
No.
Maybe you'll see one at the seaside one day.
Maybe one in Australia.
Maybe one day you'll see one in Australia. So, how many books do you think you've read?
100.
No, you've read 100 books, but you're only 6 years old. And maybe just one last question before I come back to you, Sherry. Do you think that one day you might write a book yourself?
Yeah.
Yeah? What would you write about?
About dragons.
Oh, that's a good one. What, the ones that breathe fire or the friendly ones?
Breathe fire.
Oh, so the scary ones. You're smiling. Well, I would like to read that book very much. So, Sherry, we've got a young reader here whose love for books is really clear, and that's really wonderful because I have kids who are slightly older and, you know, I used to like reading with them as well. Sadly, the mobile phone and the tablets and everything else takes over, and you're aiming at 6 to 12-year-olds, which is pretty much a great age to catch young readers. But isn't it a very ambitious project trying to get readers on board in the first place?
Well, I have to say I'm quite optimistic about this. Having worked in the publishing industry for such a long time, we see that children are just so attracted to books, even today, even with the competition of screens and phones and all the other content that is out there. And actually, the numbers prove my point. This is maybe one of the positive outcomes of the pandemic, is that 2020 was a historic year for sale of the sale of nonfiction children's books in particular, and it's just gone up since then. This year, we're seeing huge growth in fiction. And what's very interesting to note is that it's topics that are really closely related to the Sustainable Development Goals, things where books where children can help develop skills that allow them to overcome challenges, topics like climate change or conservation or environment-related themes, which is really encouraging for us to see, as well as books about friendship or being a good friend or kindness and values that we have. So I think it's really encouraging not just to see an increase in reading over the course of the pandemic, but on these themes that really are very important to the United Nations and also just to the global community.
Back to you, Leo. Is it right that you can read and write in two languages?
Yes.
Which ones are they? Obviously English. What's the other one?
Dutch.
Yeah, gosh, so you speak two languages and you're 6 years old. Okay, well listen, I know that while I was talking to Sherry, you were reading your book, so you really are a very keen reader, so good for you. Long may it continue, and I hope you get to read all the stories that you want to. But I'm going to say bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
And Sherry, what have you learned from children, from the young readers in this initiative?
First of all, we've been really inspired by the reaction that we've had from around the world to the idea of the book club, from young readers around the world in many different languages. And they really run with it. So we give them the framework, we give them the idea, and it's been wonderful to see them creating their own stories, using the books as a way to learn new languages, creating bilingual storybooks. You children are just so creative and energetic, and they've brought all of that with them to the Sustainable Development Goal Book Club. And that's what we wanted, right? We wanted people to appropriate the club for themselves and take it further and share it with people in their communities.
Thanks to Sherry Aldiss and, of course, Leo Rolfe and Mum Rachel for taking time out of reading his favourite book to talk to us on the show. Leo, you are our youngest and our most fearless guest speaker yet. I hope it was as fun for you as it was for me, and thank you for teaching me about octopuses. Listeners, if you'd like more details about the SDG Book Club, perhaps for your family or your school, you'll find masses of info online with reading lists adapted to different countries and cultures. Now to wrap up the show, I've got regular guest Solange Bejarategui-Cortez with me now. Over to you, Sol.
Gracias, Daniel. That was a breath of fresh air from the bombardment of bad news from Ukraine this past month. As Sherry said, the SDG Sustainability Book Club is inspiring. Every child who reads is a potential writer. They can become scientists, environmentalists, storytellers, or whatever they aspire to be. It's a matter of placing the right book in front of a child, and they will engage. Leo said he loves learning about octopuses. Daniel, do you know why does an octopus have 8 arms? Each one has rows of suckers and taste buds to help it pick up and taste food. Its arms are full of brain cells, so each arm has a mind of its own. It is tentacle, isn't it? I learned this from one of Leo's favorite books, The Big Book of the Blue, which is big, blue, and all about the wonderful creatures that live in the ocean. Do you know that Yuval Zomer, the author of The Big Book of the Blue, likes the work of the poet and artist Kalef Brown? He wrote a poem called Birthday Lights, and it goes like this. Light bulbs on a birthday cake. What a difference that would make. Plug it in and make a wish. Then relax and flip a switch. No more smoke or waxy mess to bother any birthday guest. But Grandpa says, it's not the same. Where's the magic? Where's the flame? To get your wish without a doubt, to blow some candles out. Let's make a wish together that all children can live and dream like children. May all children be children, go to school, play. Let's wish that children don't flee their country because of war or climate change, that they read hundreds of books, big, blue, and amazing books about octopuses. Interesting books.
Interesting books. I like it, Solange. Leo knows all about Octopus Inc. He's the new squid on the block. Get it? Thanks all for listening to the show. We'll be back next week with a hard-hitting report, this time on gender-based violence linked to forced migration. Sadly, very relevant in light of the exodus from the Ukraine war. That's it from me then. Bye-bye for now. This is the News in Brief from the United Nations. In Ukraine, more than half of the country's children have now been displaced since Russia invaded exactly a month ago. UN Children's Fund UNICEF said that 4.3 million children are on the move. This includes more than 1.8 million who've crossed into neighbouring countries as refugees and another 2.5 million who are now internally displaced inside Ukraine. UNICEF Executive Director Catherine Russell described the development as a grim milestone that could have lasting consequences for generations to come. And she warned that youngsters' safety, well-being and access to essential services were all under threat from non-stop horrific violence. Data analysis on unintended pregnancy and abortion from 150 countries has revealed major disparities in accessing sexual and reproductive health care, the UN Health Agency, WHO, said on Thursday. With partner organisation the Guttmacher Institute, the WHO said that the results would allow health authorities to better understand family planning needs in their countries, including contraception and abortion care. According to the data, which represent the first such exercise at a country level, unintended pregnancy and abortion rates vary widely, even within the same region. The greatest variations are in Latin America, where unintended pregnancy rates ranged from 41 to 107 per 1,000 women, and in sub-Saharan Africa, where the range was 49 to 145 women per 1,000. Even in regions with low unintended pregnancy rates, it is still hugely important to invest in giving women and girls the information they need to choose whether they want to have children, said the Guttmacher Institute's Jonathan Bierak, whose study appears in the journal BMJ Global Health. Sexual and reproductive health and rights are an essential part of universal health coverage and are required to end discrimination against women and girls, the WHO said. Russia's invasion of Ukraine has been the main contributing factor to the potentially devastating 1% drop in projected global economic growth this year, UN development economists UNCTAD said on Thursday in the body's latest global economic update. This year, the world economy is forecast to grow by 2.6%, down from the rosier 3.6% forecast made last September. Rising inflation is making matters worse for developing countries already weighed down by a $1 trillion debt burden to pay back creditors, the UN body said, adding that they've had insufficient support to help them withstand exchange rate instability, rising interest rates, and soaring food and fuel prices. Here's UNCTAD Secretary General Rebecca Greenspan.
We are asking for the strengthening of the measures that will help developing countries to cope with this situation. It's very important to activate the immediate funding, the rapid funding instruments that the IMF has.
UNCTAD noted that even relatively wealthy countries have already sought help from the international banking system, including Pakistan, Sri Lanka and Egypt. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Matt Wells at UN News. Medical needs in Ukraine are just cascading. That's the message from the UN World Health Organization, WHO, which is pushing hard to access people with chronic and emergency needs in large areas of the war-torn country. On the line from the eastern Ukrainian city of Dnipro, here's the agency's Tarek Yasarevich speaking to UN News' Daniel Johnson.
A WHO team has arrived to the city of Dnipro day before yesterday. That's in eastern Ukraine. The objective of this travel is to establish a logistical hub here in Dnipro, where we would pre-position medical supplies, bring them from the western part of the country, and from here dispatch them further east and south to the areas that are being attacked, where there is intense fighting, and where needs for medical material are the greatest. We are also here with the partners from other UN agencies, OCHA, UNHCR, WFP, Red Cross, and a number of NGOs, and try really to coordinate that humanitarian assistance by putting together humanitarian material in convoys that would go to these areas. So basically, the idea we have here is to establish a logistical and operational hub where we would make sure that medical supplies get faster and that we coordinate this with the wider humanitarian community.
But there were reports last night, Tarek, of strikes in Dnipro where you are now. So how safe is it for you to operate in the first place?
Well, it is relatively calm in the city. We are able to move around the city and have a number of meetings. Today, we met with district and health authorities here trying to understand the needs and try to see how WHO can assist the health authorities here in supplying medical needs, looking to possibilities to assist in medical evacuations. Obviously, we are constantly assessing security situation and safety of our staff will always be at the first place. But for the time being, we are here and we are continuing to work and to try to provide medical supplies and other assistance to health authorities.
Can you just give us an idea of how urgent it is for medical centers, which we understand have come under a significant amount of attacks, what kind of materials they need for chronic patients, for trauma patients?
Well, the needs are just cascading in areas where there are attacks, because first you will have an increasing number of people who are injured, who need trauma interventions because they've been wounded by shrapnels, by flying pieces of glass. Then there will be a limited access to healthcare services for people who have chronic diseases, leading causes of mortality in Ukraine, cardiovascular diseases, cancer, diabetes, HIV and TB also have high prevalence in areas that experience fighting, people may have difficulties accessing therapies and treatments they need. Let's not forget prenatal and postnatal care for pregnant women. Also, routine immunization for children may be interrupted in some areas that would lead to increased risk of infectious diseases such as measles, polio, rubella. COVID-19 is still there. So basically, we are really talking about a range of health issues that conflict makes worse. And then it may really put many lives at risk. So it's not just bringing medical supplies. It is really trying to say that if fighting does not stop, the health situation will get only worse.
And apparently there are some 13 million people estimated, that's the latest from the refugee agency, stranded in affected areas. So you've got millions of people to look after. How much aid can you actually get to them? I know you want to get through to the east as well.
Well, we have already brought 150 metric tons of medical supplies, mainly surgical material, but also essential medicines into Ukraine. And then we are trying to supply where there is the biggest need. We are establishing supply lines to different parts of the country together with the health authorities. And there are other organizations that are providing medical material. Now, where the problem is really the access to the most affected areas. And for that, for example, places like Mariupol that we have not been able to reach, there has to be some sort of negotiated agreement to guarantee security so all humanitarian assistance can be dispatched.
But of course, people want to know about Mariupol, and indeed those stuck in Mariupol, apparently they have no communications with the outside world or very little. So what is the World Health Organization doing to try and facilitate that access?
Well, it's a wider UN community that is ready. For example, here in Dnipro, we have all necessary supplies that can be loaded onto trucks and being sent to Mariupol once we get those security guarantees. And colleagues from the United Nations office are working on that. But unfortunately, we as the humanitarians, we cannot really stop the bombs, and we need to be assured that these convoys will not be attacked and will be able to reach. So we will continue at all levels to try to advocate for the access.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. A month since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, people's health needs there are dire and getting worse. UN Health Agency Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said on Wednesday, the situation is particularly critical in Mariupol and elsewhere, Tedros said, where the World Health Organization or WHO has not been able to dispatch a humanitarian convoy because of the ongoing violence. Other Ukrainian cities have received 150 tons of medical supplies from the WHO hub in Lviv in western Ukraine, but access to many locations remains blocked. Tedros issued an appeal to Russia to stop the war before condemning ongoing attacks on hospitals, patients and medical staff.
WHO has now verified 64 attacks on healthcare since the start of the war, and we are in the process of verifying further attacks. Attacks on health must stop. Health systems, facilities and health workers are not and should never be a target.
UN Chief Antonio Guterres set an ambitious five-year global deadline on Wednesday to ensure that people worldwide are protected by early warning systems against extreme weather and climate change. Marking World Meteorological Day, Mr. Guterres said that early warnings and action save lives. He added that the World Meteorological Organization, or WMO, would lead the effort and present an action plan in November at this year's UN Climate Conference, or COP27, in Egypt. Mr. Guterres warned that human-caused climate disruption is now damaging every region and that it was unacceptable that one-third of the world's people are still not covered by early warning systems. This mainly involves least developed countries and small island developing states, and the situation is even worse in Africa, where 60% of people lack early warnings on storms, heat waves, floods and drought. World TB Day is marked on the 23rd of March, and this year the World Health Organization, WHO, has called for urgent investment in the fight against tuberculosis to save millions more lives. Although TB is preventable and curable, it remains one of the world's deadliest infectious killers. Each day it claims more than 4,100 lives, and close to 28,000 people fall ill after becoming infected, and this despite the fact that 66 million lives have been saved since 2000. The need for global action is more urgent than ever, the WHO said, as the COVID-19 pandemic has reversed years of progress in preventing TB transmission, meaning that for the first time in over a decade, TB deaths increased in 2020. Conflicts across Eastern Europe, Africa and the Middle East have made vulnerable populations more susceptible to TB, underscoring the need to ensure that commitments made by global leaders to end TB are met. The UN Health Agency said that global spending on TB diagnostics, treatments and prevention in 2020 was less than half of the annual global target of $13 billion. For research and development, an extra $1.1 billion per year is needed. In Kenya, a sustainable agriculture project has helped farmers move away from the harmful practice of growing tobacco in favour of a healthier alternative, the UN said on Wednesday. The scheme offers training to tobacco farmers so that they can switch to alternative crops that are easier to harvest, such as beans. So far, growers have sold 135 tonnes of beans to the World Food Programme, or WFP, providing them significantly more income than from tobacco farming. Growing beans has the added advantage that they're full of iron, which helps to counter numerous health and development problems among children and pregnant women. The project has seen farmers' health improve, increased school attendance from children previously working on farms, and better crops for the environment replacing tobacco, said UN agencies WHO and FAO, who noted that tobacco farmers and their families are exposed to serious health risks from the nicotine that is absorbed through the skin when handling wet tobacco leaves, exposure to heavy use of pesticides, and to tobacco dust. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Up to 90% of the Ukrainian population could end the year living on $5.50 a day or less if Russia's invasion continues for months on end, according to the UN Development Programme representative in the country. Before the war, the figure was just 2%. Dafina Gacheva told UN News' Nargis Shekinskaya that Ukraine and its people were going through a living hell as the bombardment continues, with more than 30% of businesses already shuttered and over $100 billion of infrastructure damage already recorded after just a month of fighting.
Ukraine and its people are really going through a living hell, and our hearts are broken by the nightmare. We are witnessing the fastest moving emergency and the biggest humanitarian catastrophe in Europe since the Second World War. Nearly 1 month into the war, a major humanitarian crisis and development emergency are looming in Ukraine. The military invasion of Ukraine is causing major disruption of transport, shipping, farming, logistics and other sectors, which coupled with the massive destruction of civil infrastructure, social and energy facilities has already hit more than 12 million people, which is a quarter of Ukraine's population. Millions of people are facing severe shortages of food, electricity, medicines and healthcare. Supplies of food, water and medicines are really dwindling. FAO estimates that the hostilities would trigger an increase in international food prices between 8% to 22%. 6.5 million people are on the move, fleeing the country to escape the shelling and the fighting and save their and their children's lives. And another 6 million are forcefully internally displaced, their IDPs. As millions of people are now on the move, forced to shelter in crowded spaces with limited sanitation facilities and access to health services, the risk of infectious diseases outbreaks continues to rise, which is really threatening and very, very concerning. According to recent government estimates, at least 100 billion worth of infrastructure, buildings, roads, bridges, hospitals, schools, and other physical assets have already been destroyed. More than 30% of Ukrainian businesses have shut down completely, and the rest are operating way below their capacity.
Describe, please, Ukraine's projected development setbacks, and why should we care when the immediate need is humanitarian?
Well, data estimates suggest that before the war, roughly 2% of the Ukrainian population was living below the poverty line, which was estimated for Ukraine at $5.5 per day. According to UNDP's recent scenario modeling, up to 90% of the population of Ukraine could be facing poverty and extreme economic vulnerabilities in the event of protracted war, setting the country, and actually the spillover effect will be beyond Ukraine, setting the country and the region back decades and leaving deep social and economic scars for generations to come. Ukraine could lose up to, if not more than 18 years of socioeconomic achievements with substantial spillover effects, as I've already mentioned, in other countries in the region and beyond our region. While currently the focus is indeed, and rightly so, on humanitarian aid, UNDP, in close coordination and collaboration with other UN agencies, development partners, government counterparts, civil society organizations, grassroots organizations, and also the private sector, is addressing the development impact of the war.
What programs is UNDP setting up to mitigate those setbacks?
UNDP is among the largest UN agencies on the ground here in Ukraine, and we are fully operational throughout the war. I mean, we managed to ensure that we reposition swiftly and smoothly, and we operate 24/7. So that we can really meet the needs of the people of Ukraine. We are boosting our presence through the deployment of search advisors and also through the mobilization of targeted technical assistance and also financial support in key areas such as debris management, environmental hazards, damage assessment, mine action, energy, emergency livelihoods, and many others. Over the past three decades, UNDP has established trustworthy partnerships with the three branches of power, executive, legislative, and judiciary, also with civil society and the private sector, and we have programmatic presence in all 24 regions or oblasts of Ukraine. And we've been working with more than 330 municipalities, 15 civil society organizations, hubs, and 27 business membership associations. So we are also, UNDP is also the operational backbone of the United Nations system on the ground, and we are providing immediate support to the UN Crisis Coordinator, as well as operational support for the humanitarian response and also for a large number of UN system agencies, funds, and programs.
What is most needed now and in weeks, months, or years from now?
Well, we are assessing to the best of our abilities because of the security situation. We are assessing the impact of the war on the economy, social fabric, and environment. We are also helping to ensure that critical supplies are in place to meet, for example, emergency medical demands through providing Ukraine's Ministry of Health with blood tests, for example. These tests are used for transfusion during surgeries, in particular for wounded civilian population, and you know that there are so many thousands of civilians who have been already wounded and injured. So these tests are preventing the unintentional spread of infections such as HIV and hepatitis. As of today, 50% of the annual amount requested by the government, by the Ministry of Health, was delivered to meet the needs of some 100,000 people in Ukraine. UNDP is also providing direct support to the IDPs, internally displaced people, and also to the affected communities through, for example, provision of sets of mattresses and pillows, washing machines, refrigerators, boilers, kitchen supplies, etc. This all were sent to several IDP shelters in different regions, in different oblasts of Ukraine. We have also installed power generators at the outpatient clinic in, I can't pronounce the name of this, but it is in Chekhovsky region. And this is a city which is hosting more than 3,500 IDPs from different regions, from Donetsk, Kharkiv, Kiev, and Luhansk oblasts. We are delivering, we have actually already delivered special equipment and tools to emergency workers in different oblasts for Ukraine, thus enabling them to rescue people trapped under the rubble of buildings destroyed by the heavy shelling. We are providing also food supplies like vegetables, cookies, eggs, tea and coffee to emergency service personnel working in Luhansk. We are supporting a volunteer NGO at the Rivne Humanitarian Aid Distribution Center. We have already provided this NGO with 10 laptops and 10 cell phones, which will strengthen the capacity of the NGO to effectively track and to effectively track the delivery of humanitarian aid to conflict-affected populations.
One month ago, the Russian Federation launched a massive invasion of the sovereign territory of Ukraine in violation of the UN Charter. It was done after months of building up a military force of overwhelming proportion along the Ukrainian border. Since then, we have seen appalling human suffering and destruction in cities, towns and villages. Systematic bombardments that terrorize civilians, the shelling of hospitals, schools, apartment buildings and shelters. And all of it is intensifying, getting more destructive and more unpredictable by the hour. 10 million Ukrainians have been forced from their homes and are on the move. But the war is going nowhere fast. For more than 2 weeks, Mariupol has been encircled by the Russian army and relentlessly bombed, shelled and attacked. For what? Even if Mariupol falls, Ukraine cannot be conquered city by city, street by street, house by house. The only outcome to all this is more suffering, more destruction and more horror as far as the eye can see. The Ukrainian people are enduring a living hell, and the reverberations are being felt worldwide with skyrocketing food, energy and fertilizer prices threatening to spiral into a global hunger crisis. Developing countries were already suffocating under the burden of COVID and the lack of access to adequate financing. Now they are also paying a heavy price as a result of this war. At the same time, we cannot lose hope. From my outreach with various actors, elements of diplomatic progress are coming into view on several key issues. There is enough on the table to cease hostilities now and seriously negotiate now. This war is unwinnable. Sooner or later it will have to move from the battlefield to the peace table. And that is inevitable. The only question is how many more lives must be lost? How many more bombs must fall? How many Mariupols must be destroyed? How many more Ukrainians and Russians will be killed before everyone realizes that this war has no winners, only losers? How many more people will have to die in Ukraine? And how many people around the world will have to face hunger for this to stop? Continuing the war in Ukraine is morally unacceptable, politically indefensible, and militarily nonsensical. What I said from this podium almost 1 month ago should be even more evident today. By any measure, by even the shrewdest calculation, it is time to stop the fighting now and give peace a chance. It is time to end this absurd war. Thank you.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. UN Chief Antonio Guterres on Tuesday said that it's time for a diplomatic solution to be found to end Russia's invasion of Ukraine and end its unwinnable and indefensible war there. The Secretary General was speaking to journalists outside the Security Council in New York, telling them from his own outreach efforts, elements of diplomatic progress were coming into view on several key issues.
The war is going nowhere fast. For more than 2 weeks, Mariupol has been encircled by the Russian army and relentlessly bombed, shelled and attacked. For what? Even if Mariupol falls, Ukraine cannot be conquered city by city, street by street, house by house. The only outcome to all this is more suffering, more destruction and more horror as far as the eye can see.
Nearly a month since Russia invaded Ukraine, more than 3.5 million refugees have fled the country, UN humanitarians have said. In Poland, where 2 million Ukrainians are sheltering, the World Health Organization, WHO, said that many refugees had chronic healthcare needs, requiring urgent assistance. Here's Dr. Palomi Kuchi, WHO representative in Poland.
As you can imagine, access to healthcare in Ukraine is very restricted. And on top of that, refugees are coming from a long, difficult, dangerous journey, you know, until they arrive to the border of Poland. Children are traveling for days without the proper food, without the proper water. They are tired, they are worried.
The development comes amid reports that Russian shelling has continued to target heavily built-up areas inside Ukraine. Latest UN Health Agency data has now confirmed 62 attacks on healthcare inside Ukraine since Russian forces invaded on the 24th of February. Reflecting the global commodity price crunch made worse by Russia's invasion of Ukraine, UN humanitarians in Haiti warned that it would likely hurt vulnerable people in the highly import-dependent island nation. In an alert on Tuesday, the UN World Food Programme, WFP, warned that hunger levels in Haiti were rising unabated amid persistent political instability, growing inflation and recurrent disasters. Much of the island's wheat comes from Russia and Canada, said WFP Country Director Pierre Honorat.
So if the wheat flour is going up, you will see a problem. And as I say, the price has already multiplied by 5 in 2 years. So what we can only expect is that it will multiply again.
Needs remain high in the southern part of Haiti, where communities are still reeling from a devastating earthquake that hit in August 2021. In the north, heavy flooding in January hit Haitians hard, prompting WFP to scale up its response with daily food deliveries. More than 4 in 10 Haitians are food insecure, including 1.5 million who require an emergency response. In Mozambique's Cabo Delgado province, unrelenting violence and bloodshed has forced thousands to flee their homes since the start of the year, the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, said on Tuesday. It comes 1 year after attacks in the northern coastal town of Palma by suspected al-Shabaab militants who began an insurgency in 2017. UNHCR's Boris Cheshekov told journalists in Geneva that attacks by non-state armed groups between January and mid-March had displaced 24,000 people in Nangad district in the far north. They need humanitarian assistance and protection services urgently, said Mr. Cheshekov, who added that hundreds of families are reportedly still on the move.
Those fleeing violence suffered and witnessed atrocities, including killings, the decapitation and dismemberment of bodies, sexual violence, kidnappings, forced recruitment by armed groups, and torture. The threat of renewed violence means the number of people arriving in Weta continues to increase.
UNHCR is working with partners and local authorities to help the displaced. It is providing shelter materials and household items to vulnerable families, monitoring those with protection needs, and supporting authorities to manage sites hosting the displaced. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Connor Lennon from UN News. The solutions to restoring the health of the ocean, which provides us with oxygen, food and livelihoods, are out there. And in 100 days, they'll be on the spotlight in Lisbon, Portugal, at the second ever UN Oceans Conference. The event, taking place this June, will be a critical opportunity to mobilize partnerships and increase investment to fight ocean pollution, overfishing and other challenges.
Laura Quiñones spoke to the UN Secretary-General's Special Envoy for the Ocean, Peter Thompson, and he began by explaining how UN Ocean Conferences came into existence and why they're important.
When we brought SDG 14 into existence back in 2015 with the other 17 Sustainable Development Goals, SDG 14, to conserve and sustainably manage the resources of the ocean, didn't really have a home. You know, it wasn't like the health SDG, which had WHO, or the agriculture one, which had FAO, and so on. So particularly the advocates for SDG 14, who are the small island developing states and some of the coastal states and some of our allies, we said that we need some kind of discipline to ensure that the implementation of SDG 14 was on track, and if it wasn't, how to bring it on track. So that's how the first UN Ocean Conference came into existence in 2017, mandated by the UN General Assembly. And now we have the second UN Ocean Conference, which is, as you say, happening in Lisbon this year. So this is the process that keeps SDG 14 honest. And that honesty, of course, is extremely important, because there is no healthy planet without a healthy ocean, as the mantra goes.
How much have we advanced in ocean conservation since the last ocean conference?
Definitely not enough. There was a target for 2020 to have 10% of the ocean covered in marine protected areas. We got to close to 8%. You know, we need to do a lot more work on this, because marine protected areas are an essential part of saving the health of the ocean. Now, in the Kunming CBD COP 15 this year, you know, this is the biodiversity COP, there is a proposal which 84 countries, I think at last count, are supporting for there to be a 30 by 30 target. In other words, 30% of the planet, actually, which obviously includes the ocean, being protected by 2030. So that's a lot more ambitious than what we currently have in SDG 14.5, which is the one that sets out that 10% one. But it's one which I believe is achievable, and we're moving in that direction.
Climate change is a matter of survival, but especially when we speak about small island developing states. As a Fijian yourself, Mr. Ambassador, what would you tell to people around the world to relate to what is happening in this state?
The news is not good, and you've seen the latest IPCC report. You know, I'm a grandfather, and you know what I care about, and looking around at my friends in Fiji with their grandchildren, is the security of our grandchildren. And we understand that it's not just small island developing states, it's people living in river deltas, think of Bangladesh or the Mekong, and it's people living in cities that are built on low alluvial foundations. The security does not look good for them for a 2 to 3 degree world, which is, you know, where we're currently heading. So that's why you'll find that the small island developing states, Fiji amongst them, are at the forefront of the battle to transform our consumption and production patterns so that we don't go to that 2 to 3 degree world. 1.5, as the saying goes, 1.5 to stay alive. That's still our ambition. It's getting diminishing every day in terms of the possibility of keeping to 1.5. But we're the ones that call for that ambition to be high. Whether you're from a small island developing state or a river delta, it's a matter of survival of not just grandchildren, but of cultures that have existed for thousands of years in those locations.
What concrete actions can we take to keep 1.5 alive and protect our oceans?
Well, you know, go to the UNFCCC COP26, see what came out of that, where we're heading for COP27 in Sharm el-Sheikh in November. And, you know, it's about cutting down the use of fossil fuels, obviously. You don't need me to tell you that. But, you know, those coal-burning activities, every belch that comes out of every one of those chimneys is another nail in the coffin of those countries, which are, those environments which I've just been talking about. And, you know, let's be honest with ourselves. It's every one of us. As we come out of this COVID pandemic, are we going to just go back to what we were doing before, or are we going to try and eat more sustainably, travel more sustainably, shop more sustainably? Has the pandemic taught us a lesson? Hopefully it has, and we'll be building back not just better, but we'll be building back greener and bluer.
What do you think is hindering the progress to protect the ocean?
Well, progress for me in terms of ocean protection is all about implementing SDG 14. And that's, you know, as you know, got quite a few targets. It's about pollution, it's about overfishing, it's about the effects of greenhouse gas emissions, it's about getting marine protected areas in place, and so on. First of all, I think it's very doable. I don't lose sleep on whether we're going to achieve this or not. We are going to achieve this by 2030. I think of things like SDG 14.6, to rid the world of harmful fisheries subsidies that lead to overfishing and lead to illegal fishing and so on. That is a very doable act, and the time to do it is at the WTO ministerial conference in June this year. A doable thing. And who's going to do it? The member states of this world. And if they fail, they fail all of us. Are they going to do it? I'm sure they will, because they've looked at Nairobi and saw that member states in Nairobi grasped that nettle of consensus and said, let's do the right thing by people and planet. Let's get this treaty to ban and control plastic pollution. Let's bring it into reality. They've appointed an intergovernmental negotiating committee to get that treaty up and running, and they will finish their work on that by the end of 2024. So it's doable. This stuff is doable. That's SDG 14.1, by the way, which is why I'm so excited about it, because when you talk about marine pollution, which is SDG 14.1, 80% of it is plastic. So by getting this treaty in place, an internationally binding treaty in place to combat plastic pollution, we're going to hit that 14.1 target. No problem.
Do you remember any solutions, or have you seen any solutions that people are actually implementing right now to protect the ocean that you would like to highlight?
Look, there's 1,000 solutions, and a fleet of them will be launched at the UN Ocean Conference in Lisbon. But, you know, rather than going into individual ones, I would say be prepared for that fleet. One that I particularly like talking about is nutrition. You know, we all know that the sea provides very healthy nutrition compared with some of the other things that are produced on land. We don't eat what our grandparents ate. We have a totally different diet, which is, in fact, why obesity is such a problem around the world. But our grandchildren will be eating very differently from what we eat. They won't be eating big fish, for example. They will still be eating fish, but they'll be small fish which are grown in sustainable aquaculture conditions. They'll be eating a lot more algae, and that may not sound appetizing to you, but you're already eating it in your sushi with the nori that's around your sushi. That's seaweed, right? That's algae. The biggest source of food in the world, really, is unexploited by anybody other than whales, phytoplankton. You know, they will be eating some kind of marine tofu, which is made from phytoplankton. We'll be farmers of the sea rather than hunter-gatherers, which is what we still are. It's the only place we still are, which is out on the ocean. So those sort of transformations are underway, but we have to invest in the transformations, and we have to start doing that now.
And as individuals, what can I do to protect the ocean? What can I do to support this very important thing?
I think you have to think first about source to sea, very important. You know, I see people throwing cigarette butts into the gutter. And they don't think about the fact that, you know, the filter of that cigarette is microplastics, and that it's heading in one direction, which is down the drain into the sea eventually, and that's more microplastics going into the ocean. And the microplastics, of course, are coming back to them when they're eating their fish and chips, because those microplastics are being absorbed into life in the ocean. That cycle is going on, whether people realize it or not. So I think source to sea, really important, but you know, that relates to our industries, to agriculture, to the chemicals that are coming down the same drains and rivers out into the sea and poisoning the lagoons that we rely on for healthy marine ecosystems. So what can we do? We can just adopt a better behavior as human beings in that regard, in terms of pollution. Look at your plastic use and say, do I really need all this plastic in my life? I'm old enough to remember a world with no plastic. It was very nice, thank you. You can make your own decisions about your nutrition, but I remember my wife and I, when we were living here in New York, looking at that, you know, just one more report about what beef was doing to the Amazon, and we looked at a photo of our grandchildren and said, what do we love more, you know, hamburgers or our grandchildren? And we decided then and there, it was about 5 years ago, to give up beef. Do you need to own a car? I mean, a lot of people do need to own cars, but my wife and I, we haven't had a car. We've been living in cities now for quite a while. We haven't had a car for decades. You rely on public transport and walking, which, of course, is the best way to get around. Individuals have to make the right choices that make this world a sustainable place.
Going back to the Oceans Conference that's coming up, what's the key thing you're expecting to achieve in that conference?
You know, there's so many levels of that. And I don't know if you were at the COP26 in Glasgow, but look, the hard work that goes on in plenary of related to text, right, and agreements. But I have to be honest with you, I didn't go into plenary at all. And I was so tied up in what was happening around the outside of plenary with all these new ideas and all these side events and all the displays and so on. There was just so much to learn up there outside of plenary. So you've got the people that need to go into plenary and do the hard work on the texts and the agreements and putting their national positions, and that's a necessary part of a UN conference. But in Lisbon, we also want to generate outside of that formal process just the excitement of new ideas, of innovation, and that will be in these side events. And I'm very confident that there's going to be this innovation, which is going to be visible in that carnival-type atmosphere that you develop around that central core of the conference. Of course, science-based, innovative partnerships is the other big thing, public and private, and north and south, east and west. This is a universal moment. A UN conference is always a universal moment. And the first Ocean Conference in 2017 was a game changer in terms of waking the world up to the ocean's problems. I think this conference in Lisbon in June is going to be about providing the solutions to the problems that we've alerted the world to. And I'm very confident that those solutions are going to emerge when we get there.
We really, really hope so as well. UN Secretary General's Special Envoy for the Ocean, Ambassador Peter Thompson. I'm Laura Quiñones, UN News.